What's in my journal? Odd things, like a button drawer. Mean things, fish hooks, barbs in your hand. But marbles, too. A genius for being agreeable. Junkyard crucifixes, voluptuous discards. Space for knickknacks, and for Alaska. Evidence to hang me, or to beautify. Clues that lead nowhere, that never connected anyway. Deliberate obfuscation, the kind that takes genius. Chasms in character, loud emissions, mornings that yawn above a new grave. Pages you know exist, but you can't find them. Someone's terribly inevitable life story, maybe mine. That was What's in My Journal by William Stafford. While it may be a stretch to believe that the hands tell a life's whole story, writers would be severely handicapped without them. Will Shakespeare voices his devotion to hands in this piece from Romeo and Juliet. Romeo, here he takes Juliet's hand. If I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle sin is this. My lips, two blushing pilgrims, ready stand to smooth that rough touch with a tender kiss. This is Shakespeare at his sweetest. At other times, other plays, he finds offense in the palm of the hand. Iago had Desdemona and Othello to write where he wanted them, in the palm of his hand. So, be it softened or hardened, the palm of one's hand is a curious place. Today, Mind's Eye Radio writers palm the mysterious coin, make it appear again and again, as if by magic, in the palm of my hand. You gotta hand it to Paul Thompson. He really put his finger on this topic.
I gave him a hand up, and I thought I had him in the palm of my hand. But he refused to grease my palm, so I gave him the back of my hand. He didn't blink an eye. I gave him the finger and finally a knuckle sandwich. He fingered me to a cop, who took me in hand. But I palmed the cop a fiver, and he let me go. On my way home, I passed an unemployed handyman asking for a handout. I didn't have any change handy, and in any case, I figured he needed to put his hand to some kind of paying work. At any rate, I had my hands full just taking care of myself. A bus stop was close at hand, so I took the bus home, where my wife handed me my walking papers. She said she thought when we got married that she was in good hands, but, she said, I was high-handed, and she was forced to wait on me hand and foot. I told her she was biting the hand that fed her. I had to hand it to her. She was a real handful. She was hands down the most beautiful woman I'd ever met, and at first she was eating out of my hand. But then she got out of hand, and I had to take her in hand. I have to admit, I was probably heavy-handed, but in her turn she was high-handed with me. I figured it was about time I washed my hands of her. On the one hand, I hated to see her go, but I refused to knuckle down to her. I asked her if her mother had a hand in her decision, because they were often hand in hand, but she said no. So I gave her a hand with her handmade suitcase and handed her off to whatever fate awaited her. I poured myself two fingers of whiskey and thought to myself that she had been lucky to have me because I was making money hand over fist. And maybe I was lucky to have her off my hands. I didn't realize that the divorce judge was going to hand me my head. This is Paul Thompson. Please give a hand to Mind's Eye Radio.
From Come Hither to Not Today, Guy Thorvaldsen knows hands inside and out. The lifeline carries us through the years.
Every male child born into our family is blessed by the same decree. He's got good carpenter's hands, claim aunts, uncles, grandparents, regardless of the child's actual hands. but in full understanding that good carpenter hands carried us from spare Norwegian villages clutching to the side of mountains, to the honk and wail of Brooklyn streets. They carried us through the gray blight of the Depression, through World War II, and into the new life, placing food on plates, roofs overhead, until they became my own hands. Hands that instinctively twitch at the sight of crooked doors, open finger joints, out of level truss beams. Prescient hands that ache moments before danger appears, understanding that what is at risk is not a body, but an agreement with the world to keep working. Adorned hands, etched, scarred, carved, calloused, hands that need no introduction, from which age does not subtract, but adds thick-knuckled substance. Skilled hands that can carry, hit, twist, lift, clasp, guide, tousle little boys' heads, finger bowling balls. Steady hands that gauge a woman by her response on the dance floor, to cupped palm on hip bone, knowing the difference between the sweet resistance of come hither and the cold hardness of not today. Weathered hands that cradle babies who wave their newborn hands, the pink, translucent, rain-soft skin, fingernails thin as fly wings, hands that open and close, grasping hold of their father's sandpaper rough forefinger, like clutching a tree branch to pull themselves to standing. This is Guy Thorvaldsen for Mind's Eye Radio.
Donna Carnes.
My poem, Ultima Thule, is about the human condition of perceived comfort and fear. It's about the dialectic between feeling safe, experiencing trauma, and individual growth. It is about thinking you live with your life in order within the safety net of your known world, when in actual fact, the edge of the unknown and the unease the unknown brings can be perched right beside you as you drink your morning coffee and read about the most recent political games being played. For sometimes, things are in the palm of your hand, the wild and the tame, there for you to pluck, and you don't even see them, as they are hidden beneath the filters through which you see yourself. One last note, in European classical and medieval literature and geography, Ultima Thule is the northernmost remote place on Earth. Ultima Thule. I live by the edge of the furthest land. I am a lost soul gone trekking. I live by the edge of the first water. I am a fisherman lost in the innocent sea. I live by the edge of the falling fog. I am a weaver of lost memories. I live by the edge of the last road north. I am a lake dweller seeking lost fire. I live by the edge of the hidden sun. I am a keeper of lost light. I live by the edge of the old moon. I am a healer. I shepherd lost time. Unhurried is a poem about being inside of a time and place, inside of a day in mid-November in the rural driftless area of southwestern Wisconsin, which is unglaciated, hilly land containing deeply cut river valleys. Unhurried. It's a still November day, out in the driftless land, with the sun on my back and a hardening ground. I can feel a nip in the oaky air. The pup's at my feet while the old boy walks upstream, sniffing out treats on the bank. There, in a single moment, the world turns. This is Donna Carnes for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Fran Rahl makes a case for using the body for what God may not have intended, a notebook to the soul, a memory aid, a greeting card.
The palm reader. She writes important things on her hand with ink. When she was a child, she was always careful to scrub the palm before a test. Do this, do that, her palm reads. Big things like, write that grant, noted as grant. RX means stopping by the drugstore. What a neat method. Well, not neat exactly, but concise anyway. She starts off each day with a clean palm. My notes are on a piece of paper stuck to the telephone wall. I can forget them for a time, weeks even. So I guess she's more efficient. Use it or lose it, one might say. No saving for another day. So, on my left breast, I will write, smile, love the world. On the right, good morning for my partner, love me tender. And on the rear, pat gently, don't spank, and don't sit for longer than 1 hour. This is Fran Rahl signing off for Mind's Eye Radio with, actually, clean hands.
Poet Sharon Van Sluis.
At the last Northeastern University where I taught poetry, I was hired to replace a rather conservative retiring established poet well regarded for his work in prosody. I was happy to get the job, as jobs for poets are few. However, within the first week of teaching, at least two of my new colleagues commented that they had expected me to dress more flamboyantly, more gypsy-like. I wore what I always wore to teach, the women's equivalent of Brooks Brothers suits. Apparently, it was generally expected that because many of my poems were not composed in strict metrical form, I would be a wild, free spirit who would wear gypsy skirts and comb her hair only slightly, or perhaps dress entirely in black and smoke thin cigars. No one asked me, though they may have wanted to, if I might also be an alcoholic, a heroin addict, a socialist, a manic depressive, or prone to suicidal thoughts. Those characteristics, too, people tend to stick to the idea of artist. Artists are sensitive souls, outsiders or rebels, or just weirdos who can't hold a job. That's the message from the outside. They are ideas that can imprison an artist, though most are able to ignore them and do their work. But the internal messages many artists give themselves can be a more constrictive prison, as they also contain a seed of truth. That is, that art requires constant sacrifice, and that a normal life may not be possible if one takes art seriously. And what seriously means, in the details, is that I may not have a secure career, may not marry or have a stable, loving relationship, may not have children or the whole host of other normal comforts to fall back on if things get difficult as I pursue my art. Serious means that I do my art believing that I actually have something crucial and universal, not simply personal, to say to the world, and that I also believe I have not only the talent, but the discipline and the will to draw up into consciousness and communicate clearly what others may only mutely sense to be true. The inner message of the artist, especially hard for those who find themselves blocked or sense they are failing, that inner requirement of the artist is the abandonment of what the great Greek writer Nikos Kazantzakis portrayed as the last temptation of Christ, the desire to live the normal life, to be a comfortable nobody, to live life just like everybody else. This poem is about an artist I knew who fell to the power of his own inner message about the cost of his failure. It begins with a rather pointed epigraph by Samuel Beckett. To be an artist is to fail as no other dare fail. That failure is his world, and to shrink from it, desertion, arts and crafts, good housekeeping, living. Photo of you, David in background. It is black and white, Firenze, September. I'd ask you to pose in the careful light of the Accademia. No flash, I was so artistic. You in your constant black against the impossible whiteness and praxitilian lines. It is not grief that draws me back. You were so decisive, no one could call it tragedy, no sad and freakish slip of the mind. It was your alternate path, your secret black capsule, a plan B I had never guessed or seen. In time, I sorted the pieces and pieced it back, a keen eye for signs of gravest intention, the signs you made and followed, quick and sudden, out of your one and only life. On the left and out of focus, the museum guard, one dark arm and the leg of her folding chair. I recall she hooked you with a hostile stare, her fierce eyes dogged you. I thought it odd, misplaced, a moody artist, innocuous you. But I see now she knew, trained to catch the twitch that betrays a mind set on violence. She tensed, ready for yet another failed crazy man with a hammer, craving the perverse immortality to be earned in some monstrous unmaking. And you, with no dangling camera, no tattered map, no rapt look of awe in this hall of the noumena, she pegged you in partibus. She caught the faint whiff of it, some bad intention, and stiffly watched. You were no danger. It would be weeks later, and then alone, discreet, a rented room, an exercise in neatness. I saw nothing, and blithely snapped this abstract pattern in black and white. How clear it is now, in that fixed moment, your body closed in, turning to stone, rigid against the sublime curve of the perfect ankle and the perfect calf, line of the David, giant, ideal and self-supporting, and here, ironic, the huge anagogical hand stopped in time, stopped in its inevitable motion towards glory, hand you had seen in 100 places, hand of the Sistine, hand of Adam, hand of the Maker, immortal above you. And here beneath it, your small face caught in paper and light, and the look you had worn from Bruges to Milano through 1,000 hard miles of merciless art. How clear it is now. The density of your sorrow and its direction, palpable and massive around you like the stone arch of a dark doorway. The ragged raven of your past and all your possible futures as failure shadowing you. Doppelganger, grim angel, incubus. It is small in my hand, my last photo of you. And it is not grief that brings me to say this. It is the days, my own slow and ordinary days that continue incredibly on. It is my knowing now. If I could have known how you would weasel free of that sharp threat of long life as no one, I would take you, shake you hard, and in all ways I know, show you, tell you, it is this, this, and only this, the wild and physical house of your life, its necessary keeping, the art of it, the craft of it, the precious and terrible living of it. This is Sharon Vansluis for Mind's Eye Radio.
Poet Norma Gay Pruitt.
Things that will fit in the palm of a hand. A sweaty quarter to take me up and over on the Ferris wheel. A boy's Angora-wrapped Hubs high school class ring I will lose in a theater by the same name. A tiny yellow pill that was supposed to make it possible to get on the plane, but made me fly without it instead. A green or black jelly bean I will toss later in favor of red or yellow. Another kind of pill that I found you have to take more than once. And the baby that came when it didn't work. Our tiny squirrel, baby boy, not in my palm, but like an amulet of precious redstone in the palm of his father. This is Norma Gay Pruitt saying, guess which hands it's in, for Mind's Eye Radio.
Now and then we can't even find the basket to put our eggs in. The voice of reason inside our heads stops talking, and we're at the mercy of the senseless zone. Writer Sue Renard explores the possibilities in Something in the Coffee.
Anybody home?
Hi, June. I'm in the kitchen. Come on back.
Hi, Betty. I just made a fresh batch of coffee and brought over a cup for you.
Thanks, June, but I've sworn off caffeine. 2 days and counting.
Mmm, what smells so good in here?
That's my last batch of chocolate chip cookies. Could you get that out for me?
Oh, sure.
An ordinary woman doing ordinary things. A neighbor comes over and unthinkingly picks up a hot pan with her bare hands. An ordinary occurrence? Sometimes. It's hard to tell. In the senseless zone.
Hey, quiet! Quiet, please! Please, everyone, quiet! I've called this meeting because we don't have much time. As you know, the Midwest has just been declared a disaster area. No one really knows what's going on yet. But I have someone here who may be able to help us. Let me introduce Betty Collins from Friendly, Wisconsin. She's just been telling me it all began with a neighbor. Is that right, Mrs. Collins?
Yes, General, that's right. Though I didn't think anything of it at the time. She wasn't really hurt that badly. But the very next day, my husband and I were sitting around the breakfast table when he suddenly jumped up, gulped the last of his coffee, and dashed out of the room. I found him a minute later standing tiptoe on a swivel chair trying to change a light bulb. Luckily, I caught the chair just as it started to roll out from under him.
Oh, my hair is terrible.
Oh, yeah, I've done the same thing myself sometimes.
That's what I mean. That's why it took me so long to see there was a pattern. Oh, there were a few more things that day that were just as odd. I learned my friend Mark was marrying a twice-divorced woman he had only known for a week. And then on the third day, I got a call from my brother Jack.
Hello?
Betty, it's Jack. You won't believe this. I just quit my job.
What? Quit your job? What happened?
Well, it's good news, really. I don't need to work anymore because I just won $10 million. $10 million!
What?
I just won $10 million.
How?
That's what's so funny. I didn't have to do a thing. This letter just arrived telling me I was a winner. It had that old guy's picture on it. You know, the one who used to work with Johnny Carson.
Oh, Jack.
Tell you, General, that's when I figured something was really wrong. Jack used to be one of the most level-headed people I knew. After that, things got worse quickly. The temperature was soaring into the high 90s that day, and I decided to go to the mall to cool off and do some shopping. When I was walking toward the store, I passed several cars that were left running, the keys in the ignition and the doors unlocked. Then, right near the door, I passed five cars, all with their windows rolled tight, each with a baby or a dog trapped inside. You could see they were suffering. It was horrible. So I ran to a nearby phone. Hey, excuse me. You on the phone? I've got an emergency here.
Hey, lady, back off. I'm talking to my psychic here.
But this is an emergency. There are lives at risk. Give me that phone.
Hey, stop that.
No, but you don't
knock
understand.
Knock it off.
Give me that phone.
Hey, you knocked over my coffee. Now my shirt's going to be stained.
I tried calling 911. But all I got was a busy signal, so I rushed over to a nearby gas station looking for help. Just as I got there, a kid came out of the door holding one of those giant mugs. He took a gulp and set it on top of the car, which was still running, by the way, lit a cigarette and started pumping gas. I yelled at him that he didn't have the sense he was born with, but he wouldn't listen to me. I drove out of there right away, headed to the police station. A mile later, I heard a boom, and then a black cloud rose in the sky.
Oh, it's quite a story, Mrs. Collins. Do you have any theories about what was happening?
I've had a lot of time to think of this, General. There must be something that's sucking the common sense out of people. What better way to disarm the Earth than by having all the humans become incompetent?
General? General, sorry to interrupt, but we just got a coded message from NORAD. Seems we've lost the western seaboard.
What happened?
Early this morning, the utilities started sensing odd power surges throughout the Pacific states. They got more and more frequent until the whole power grid went down. Best they could tell, millions of people were using their hair dryers while in the bathtub.
Oh. Gentlemen, ladies, we can't delay any longer. I must call the president.
Mr. President.
Mr. President, General Arthur here. We've got a situation.
What's that? Speak up a little.
Mr. President, we've just lost the West Coast. Something is robbing everyone of their common sense.
Just a minute, General. I can't hear you. I'm in the tub. Here, let me turn off this radio.
Common sense. saved us from predators in our distant past, makes us safe shelter from cold and rain. It's helped the human race survive for a million years, but maybe it's outgrown us here in the senseless zone.
I can't get this baby to sleep. I've tried everything I know. I wish my dad were here.
Have you ever been in a difficult situation and just wanted a little fatherly advice? Well, Ron Cotell proudly announces the new Digital Audio Dad.
Oh, hey, wait. I've got my DAD right here.
This is your dad. Please state the crisis.
DAD, Jessica is driving me crazy. What's that bedtime story you used to tell me?
Don't panic, honey. Just hold me close to Jessica's ear. Once upon a time, there was an Easter egg named Fred who got lost in a shoe.
Yes, folks, a universe of advice and guidance at your fingertips, and a virtual shoulder to lean on when times get tough. All for the incredibly low price of just $19.99. Act now and get a DAD Advice for the Ages absolutely free. It contains such timeless classics as...
Son, you have to be the man of the family while I'm gone.
And... Young lady, I expect you to be home by 11 p.m. and not a minute later or you'll be grounded for life! As you've heard, our amazing Digital Audio Dad comes in a variety of styles and accents, each so realistic you'll swear you're talking to the real thing. This is your dad.
Oh, thank God, Digital Audio Dad. I just got a flat and I'm stuck here in the middle of nowhere. What should I do?
What are you doing driving alone on a deserted highway? You know how dangerous that is. You aren't going to visit that rock musician, are you? You know I don't approve of him. Oi, how I hate that. That's Digital Audio Dad, available now in all fine electronics stores. Get yours today.
Madison poet Judith Zuckerman.
Not every man or woman still hold hands after 42 years. Traveling companions who lose each other, entranced in Memphis's National Civil Rights Museum. Not every woman and man spend hours engrossed in Clarksdale's Delta Blues Museum. Explore Jackson's Tougaloo College on Sunday morning, remembering 1950s, 1960s civil rights days, talking to African American students about today. Not every woman and man in gentle January walk French Quarter streets in New Orleans, city of elegance faded from 1960s honeymoon. Gardens hidden from view sit behind an iron gate. She writes by scented candlelight in pre-dawn hours. Fountain water flows, white decorative lights. Classical instrumental music surround the pink and white house. Tall palms, bushes, large plants like love, planted 43 years ago, flower even in winter time. Life events weave their way through years. Love what is unique in each other. Change with time. This is Judith Zuckerman for Mind's Eye Radio.
May I be safe and protected. May I live with ease and well-being. May I be free from inner and outer harm. May I come to fully embody the blessing of freedom. May I be happy, happy. May I find peace. May I find peace.
Poet Evie Thompson.
Outside our window, chirping, peeping, chatting, the blackbird flock has settled in the trees. Last night, thin clouds, the half moon hung low. and now a bit of sunshine, all gifts on our 52nd anniversary. We are both frail, fibrillating heart, weak memory. You said to me, I'd rather have you watching my back than anyone I know. What will become of us? A fearsome question. But this blessed moment I hold in the palm of my hand. This is Evie Thompson for Mind's Eye Radio.
Thank you. by late December. She walked across at the first day of the new year. Back a gift someone sent her. Her feelings for you disappear. You're like a light she switched off. She doesn't wish to turn back on. She used to care about you. Now without you, she's moving on. Without you, she's moving on. She'll start her day with the paper, cup of tea, and you won't be on her mind. There was a time you could persuade her to believe or forgive all your lies. You thought she would have called you by now. She should have broken down. She finally learned about you. Now without you, she's moving on. Without you, she's moving on. You chose a foolish fate. You thought her love would wait. You let it slowly drown. In the story that you wrote, she is a goodbye note. Silence of the house now that you're gone. She might do a little reading. She won't wonder what went wrong. She won't lose any sleep tonight, but you'll pace the floor until dawn. She's done dreaming about you. Now without you, she's moving on. Without you, she's moving on.
This is Lynn Patrick Smith for Mind's Eye Radio.
Palm Reading by Greg Willard. Brighty scanned the coffee shop and then saw a small woman writing in a notebook who fit the description. All black clothes and long white braids. Kara, I'm Brighty. The palm reader smiled. It's wonderful to meet you. Shall we begin? Brighty opened her hands and rested them face up on the table. Or is it just one? You're left-handed? Yes. Brighty had not told her before that she was left-handed. Then the left one, please. Kara held Brighty's hand. Kara said, have you had your palm read before? Yes. Then you probably have come to expect a story of your past, a projection into your future. I am not such a palm reader. I see other things. Is that acceptable? My friend Ellie said you had helped her. I hope I can help you. There are no guarantees. Brighty nodded, and Kara began. I see that you must always use your hands in a way that others can watch. Your hands must always serve your spirit's purposes freely and must acquire the self-possession that quietly forms habits both bad and good. There is a love of heights, swinging from things. The stunt artist aspect of you is reflected in the feelings that satisfaction might be cultivated in slabs of fortune. Your hands gripping life like a cut of meat to be knifed. The stunt woman's self-possession, the way that it is reflected in your lines and gullies of pockets of this skin, is like a singer whose song is silence. Only when a stunt requires that your hands be as a posse ambushing fate can it accord with the sagebrush situation. Otherwise, your hands should be always fisted. We must also look out for the way that your hands and the life they grip and shape may easily make yourself ridiculous on the stage. Hence the absurdity of a Lohengrin who cannot sing with a helmet, or another who cannot with a shield, a third who cannot with gauntlets, a wanderer who cannot with the big hat go to another who cannot hold the spear, a Jose who cannot with the helmet, etc. All these things must be practiced in its costume, in their proper gloves, that become a habit that must be broken to completely master without any effort to be at least the least evil result. The hands who themselves are chiefly getting enough of it, as long as they take pleasure in it, and after every grip of the lover or the enemy, the steering wheel or the knife, or the servile pecking of the keyboard, or the texting of the smartphone, or the sorrowful kneading of your own face, or the feverish interlocking of fingers in the atheist prayer. All of these are your reaching for a doorknob to go through. For this reason, it is insane folly to try to hold important things on the stage of your life. After 1 or 2 years of poking, perhaps it can never be carried on in red rooms or with managers who commit a crime without a doubt in the Italian language, sticking their index fingers deep down their throats. Without another doubt, the numerous digits, the pronounced and the studied skin, the forms of opposable thumbs well into almost any form, the mixing and the combining of pressures your hand hungers to embrace, that renew with each breath, and behind it all the movies, the memory of the movies playing out on the screen of your palm, without a subject being subjected to the numinous hand signals that many a hard fist interrupt with each professed word of signed language. In that way, too, you will learn and learn, and all our fraternity must realize that the sooner or later the sewer fins the song of the incompetent palm that binds the medium and at the same time binds the holder of stunts, you. Look, your lifeline, the vaginal tongue, the palate palace, the way that the consideration of many German-like pressures have exerted your course through life, that contain in the language of your skin as many consonants as vowels, which must be pronounced and resonant on a single tone, as, for example, sprung, struck, brinkst, herbst, schweißt, brascht. We must acquire the great deftness of stroking skin, of the vocal apparatus, that is, with the mother, the larynx, the lynx, the palate, the lips, so that we can at least begin with to try clearly to undress this organ of our skin as it is formed by your hands' travail. And then that which is the story of your hand, your face, like the voles boring tunnels through the chest and the diaphragm, the larynx, the lynx, the quincunx, the preparation of the papier-mâché beasts, the living masks that most hands, but not yours, dilate to fluid, to effluvia that is clear and correctly articulated without the habit of doing by giving this skin the sound, hard, quick whack on the back of the head that will make them more flexible. You are finding your way, Bridie. You have the hand of the survivor, the explorer, the refusal to sleep in anyone else's glove. Bridie said, I don't get any of what you just told me. Karin's eyes were bright. She picked up Bridie's hand, brought it to her lips, kissing the palm gently, and then placing it against her cool, round cheek. Bridie got it.
Oh, Lord, I wish I had something new to say. Something to keep you from turning and walking away. If I could touch you so gently without a trace of greed, if I could wrap my arms around you and let go of my need. Oh Lord, I wish I had something new to say, something to turn your head, take your breath away, something that has the power to pull us from the brink, the power to change the way we act and how we think. Oh Lord, I wish I had something new to say, something to turn this dark midnight to the light of day. Just a simple gesture like opening a door. Step into a place where we've never been before. Oh Lord, I wish I had something new to say, something we haven't already said yesterday, something to shake these foundations, tear this building down, bring our armies home from this broken battleground. Oh Lord, I wish I had something new to say. Oh Lord, I wish I had something new to say.
Lewis Rawl recalls a visit to the Queen of Palmas, a reader of indeterminate, mysterious ethnic origin who saw something in the young boy's palm. We think she saw Dr. Stringlove.
Hello. Dr. Stringlove here. During times of adversity and uncertainty, it is well known that many people turn to various kinds of psychic help to see their way ahead. Astrologers, card, palm, and cranium readers, as well as crystal ball gazers, all benefit from disturbed conditions. As I'll explain later, this is not necessarily a waste of time and money, despite the flimsiness of the underlying theories and assumptions. My childhood during the Great Depression, with the Second World War coming down the pike, was a really uncertain time, and I'm reminded of my Aunt Vera's visit to the local palm reader. It was on an afternoon when my aunt was in charge of me and had an appointment with Madame Olga, so she took me with her. We entered a dimly lit anteroom where we were met by the mysterious and imposing-looking psychic. She looked ancient to me. Maybe she was about 50. Madame was born before World War I in the then Prussian city of Königsberg. As well as charmingly accented English, she spoke German, Polish, and Ukrainian. Native speakers of those languages in the neighborhood said she spoke each with a foreign accent. The Germans thought she was Polish. The Poles naturally thought she was German, while the Ukrainians always referred to her as that Russian woman. Her clients were all women, as far as I know. Actually, the lives of working-class women in those days were very predictable. Marriage to a man with a hard factory or mill job, children and housekeeping done with little money. Most of the men drank, and some took out their frustrations on their wives. If an abused woman went to her priest, she was likely told to show more respect for her husband, keep better house, and have more children for the church. It was more productive to unburden oneself to a psychic and often receive common sense and helpful advice. This is how I view the advantage of psychics to society, as therapists rather than as seers. By keen observation, seemingly casual conversation, neighborhood gossip, and revelations by other clients, Madame Olga knew a lot more about her customers than they thought she did. She could thus demonstrate her powers by telling them things about themselves they thought were secrets. This is a stock in trade of most psychics. It didn't take much insight to predict a bright future for Aunt Vera. Even I thought she was almost as pretty as my mother, and old photographs show she had what was then called a good figure. I thought of her as a grown-up. She was 19. My grandmother Stringlove had been a flyer in a circus trapeze act until an accident involving an inexperienced catcher put an end to her career. She was determined that Vera stayed on the ground, and saw to it she received secretarial training. While the reading was going on, I sat in the NA room and only heard vague murmurs through the thick curtains. A large poster depicting a palm caught my attention. I compared the lines and regions on it to my own hand. There were a lot of names, which I thought were interesting. I have since forgotten all of them except for the lifeline. There were also books, and I looked through a couple to find out how to interpret these lines and other features. The time passed, and pretty soon my aunt and Madame Olga came through the curtains. My aunt looked very happy, and her face was a little pink. I figured out much later that this was when she decided to accept the proposal of the man who became Uncle Rob. "Look," she said, "Iggy is teaching himself how to read palms." Madame Olga smiled and took my hand to look at my palm. The natural thing to do is to look at your palm if someone else does. However, I was tired of looking at mine, so I looked at her face instead. I definitely saw a startled look that quickly vanished. She gently closed my fingers over my palm and told me to come back when I was older, and she would tell me what I needed to know. However, my parents and I soon left the old neighborhood, so I never found out what Madame Olga may have thought she saw in the palm of my hand that day. This is Dr. Stringlove, holding out my hand palm up for Mind's Eye Radio.
It's said that eyes are the mirror of the soul, but perhaps hands are as much so. One can tell how firm is a person's wish to communicate by the nature of the handshake. To offer one's palm is even more intimate, a supplication, an invitation. So before you wave us off, let us leave you with this thought. We'd like to give you a hand for listening to today's Mind's Eye Radio writers. Donna Carnes, Norma Gay Pruitt, Fran Rall, Lewis Rall, Evie Thompson, Paul Thompson, Geither Waldson, Greg Willard, and Judith Zuckerman. Original music by Barbara Chusid. To listen to past Mind's Eye Radio shows, go to www.radioforall.net, and that's the number 4. I'm Greg Willard. Thanks for listening, and best wishes from Mind's Eye Radio. Did we get it?